From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, a talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist Mike Royko. He tells us about what he learned about his native Chicago growing up in his father's tavern. Rap music has been accused of promoting violence. Coming up, music critic Nelson George talks with us about Stop the Violence. It's a collaborative effort he organized with some of today's top rap stars to raise consciousness about black-on-black crime. And TV critic David Bianculli joins us with a preview of a TV movie about televangelists Jim and Tammy Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An Amtrak train carrying nearly 400 passengers and 22 crew members derailed 90 miles southeast of Des Moines, near the town of Batavia, Iowa, this afternoon. Doug Johnson has more.
The Amtrak train is carrying passengers from Seattle, Oakland, Salt Lake City, and points in between. At this time, the cause of the accident is not known, and the total number of injured is not known. The passengers are being taken to the Ottumwa Regional Health Center. Janice Simpson is the spokesperson for the hospital.
We have seen approximately 12 patients in the emergency room. We are expected to get approximately 80 patients that need to be treated, and of those 80, 20 are supposedly seriously injured.
Simpson said that buses are taking the uninjured into Ottumwa, where they are being looked after by the Red Cross. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson.
Firefighters in northern Pennsylvania worked today to put out four train cars that caught fire in a derailment last night. 29 cars in a Buffalo and Pittsburgh Railroad train went off the track last night, causing the fires and spilling crude oil and caustic chemicals. Officials say about 100,000 gallons of crude oil spilled. Workers were skimming some of the oil from a nearby creek this afternoon. No serious injuries were reported. U.S. medical experts in Wiesbaden, West Germany, have started running routine medical tests on released hostage Robert Polhill. The 55-year-old professor arrived in West Germany today after 39 months of captivity. Deirdre Berger has more.
After eating a large breakfast and taking a long nap, Robert Polhill has started undergoing a battery of tests at Lindsay Air Station Medical Center to check his health condition. In a preliminary health report, hospital officials said he was alert and stable, but tired, malnourished, and dehydrated. U.S. officials in Wiesbaden today said Polhill's captors provided him with insulin for his diabetic condition. The officials added that general talks with Polhill have begun, but the debriefing process on the conditions of his captivity has not yet started. A team of psychologists is also standing by at the military hospital to help the freed hostage readjust to life outside captivity. Hospital officials stressed today that Polhill's stay is voluntary. For National Public Radio, this is Deirdre Berger in Frankfurt.
The leader of a Muslim militia group in South Lebanon said today that two Swiss hostages will be freed soon. The two Swiss are relief workers for the International Red Cross. Militia Chief Mustafa Saad told a news agency that the Swiss hostages could be freed by Wednesday or Thursday. The two Swiss were abducted in October of last year from a clinic in South Lebanon where they fitted artificial limbs to Civil War victims. Prices fell sharply on the New York Stock Exchange today, pushed down by fears of inflation. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 29 points to close at 2,666.67. Declines led advances by 4-1. This is NPR News. The West German government announced today that it will offer to convert savings in East German marks into its much more valuable West German marks at a 1-to-1 exchange rate. The move was welcomed by East German officials who had complained that the West German Central Bank's recommendation for a 2-to-1 exchange would make them into second-class citizens. The West German Central Bank had said that only 2,000 East German marks in savings should be exchanged at a rate of 1-to-1. Bonn has raised that limit to 4,000 marks. West German central bankers had feared that a direct 1-to-1 exchange would be highly inflationary. U.S. officials met with the president of the European Community and other European trade officials today. Both sides say the talks are a sign that the U.S. now recognizes the importance of dealing with Europe as a single unified market. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Secretary of State Baker and European Community President Jacques Delors both praised the newly intensified relationship between the EC and the U.S. European and American trade officials have stepped up their schedule of meetings to 2 a year. They say they have every hope of resolving disputes over agriculture subsidies within 6 months. Agriculture subsidies are the most contentious trade issue between Europe and the U.S. The U.S. would like European countries to move faster to lift their farm subsidies. The Europeans want the U.S. to recognize that they must move gradually. Compared to U.S. trade relations with Japan, however, the relationship between the U.S. and the EC is fairly cooperative. Neither side runs a big trade surplus with the other. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Former junk bond king Michael Milken is expected to plead guilty tomorrow to charges of unlawful securities trading and filing a false tax statement. Milken is charged with 98 counts of insider trading and other charges. Sources close to the case say Milken will plead guilty to 6 lesser charges and agree to pay as much as $600 million in fines. That agreement is not said to rule out a possible prison term for Milken. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mike Royko has been writing a daily newspaper column for more than 26 years in his hometown of Chicago. He gained a reputation for his affectionate portrayals of the town's ethnic neighborhoods and for his biting commentaries about Chicago's public officials, in particular, the late mayor Richard Daley. Royko later went on to write a biography of Daley titled Boss. Today, his syndicated column appears in 525 papers. He's won dozens of awards, including the Pulitzer Prize. A collection of some of Mike Royko's recent columns was published a few months ago in the book Dr. Cookie, You're Right. In one of the columns, Royko writes about a time when he was stopped at a light and a teenage boy started washing the windshield of Royko's car, hoping to get a buck in return. Royko turned on the wipers to get rid of the kid and drove off in anger, but he was later angry with himself because he realized the kid needed the money.
I make a point of giving money to all panhandlers. I think by the time anybody's a panhandler, for one thing, the overhead is high. I don't like to give to charities where I read reports and find out they've spent 80% on administration and the rest goes to the poor. The one thing about a bum, if you give a bum a buck, there's no overhead. I mean, he gets the buck.
So you give money to everybody who asks you for it?
Yeah, I've never turned a panhandler down. I don't believe in it because, as I say, whether the guy's problem is that he's a drunk or that he's got a drug problem or that he's mentally addled in one way or another or he's given up on life. The only problem with that is you can't get a tax write-off.
How much change do you carry with you?
I don't give change.
You give dollars?
Yeah.
So you always carry a wad of singles?
Well, it's a good idea to carry a wad of money in a city like Chicago, because if you're robbed and say you only have $3 on you, anybody goes to the trouble of investing in a gun and going into a line of work where you can go to prison is going to be disappointed if all he gets is a handful of quarters. So I generally carry quite a bit of money on me, so in different parts, pockets and wallets. So that I can, I have been robbed, and I think that if they hadn't been pleased that they were showing a profit for their effort, they might have shot me. So it's really a minor investment, giving a guy 50 or 100 bucks to avoid getting shot.
So you've been robbed a couple of times, and did you have money with you both those times?
Oh yeah, because I followed that rule. I learned that a long time ago.
Would you ever tell a mugger who you are? You know, on the odd chance that maybe they read your column and like it.
I'm not a name dropper. No.
I wonder what kind of reaction you get.
Give my card. actually, that happened in Chicago. Studs Terkel was mugged in front of his house, and. The guy started wrestling with Studs. I guess Studs tried to talk to him, and the guy started wrestling with him, and they wound up on the ground. And while they were wrestling around, Studs told him who he was, and the guy said, "I've heard of you. You're a writer and a well-known personality and all that." And Studs, "That's right." And so they had a talk, but the guy still robbed him. But being Studs, who's a compulsive interviewer, he did get a good interview out of it. He discussed things as they were rolling around. He discussed things with the guy.
With his tape machine on?
No, no, he did it. No, he didn't have a tape. He was the guy who would have stolen his tape.
That's right. How do you think the tone of your columns has changed over the years?
The tone hasn't really changed, I don't think. I think the subject matter has changed considerably. When I first began my column, I stuck basically with local Chicago Midwest issues, primarily Chicago issues. Chicago politics was a great deal more fun then. And Richard J. Daley was mayor. The 60s were... It was easy to write a local column in Chicago. We had most of the things that were the great social issues of the day that they were babbling about in Washington were happening in Chicago. The civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, every major or minor social revolution was occurring here, and most of the problems that people talked about then were here. So by writing a local column, I was actually writing, without realizing it, a national-type column, except I was at the source or at the base of the problem rather than in Washington where people put things in the Congressional Record. But as the years went on, it would have been impossible for me to just write about Chicago happenings in Chicago politics. And so the only change has been that I've broadened the base of the things I write about.
Columnist Mike Royko is my guest. He has a new collection of columns called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. You've lived in Chicago all your life. Would you describe the neighborhood you grew up in?
Well, it was... I would say it was probably what you call an ethnic neighborhood. It was probably about 60% Eastern European, then a mixture of Irish and Scandinavians. It was a blue-collar neighborhood. There were no... we had a lawyer, a neighborhood lawyer, and a neighborhood doctor, and a neighborhood this and that. They didn't live right in the neighborhood. They went home a mile or two away to a fancier neighborhood when the day was over. But it was basically a neighborhood where people sat on their front porches at night and had a couple firemen, a copper, and two or three taverns on the block, and a neighborhood school. It was all things considered, a fairly stable neighborhood. There wasn't much crime. There wasn't a lot of money. We were at the tail end of the Depression, and then we came out, and then we had World War II. So it wasn't a real prosperous neighborhood. Most people didn't, the majority of people didn't own a car.
I've seen your father referred to as a tavern tycoon. What kinds of bars did he run?
Well, he had a tavern, and over the years, that's where he had a tavern. It was really basically his first tavern. Later, he sold that and bought taverns in other parts of the city, trying to, you know, get a bigger and more profitable place. But that was where I grew up. Is where he had his first tavern.
So your father ran one of the bars in the neighborhood?
Yeah, he had the most popular bar in the neighborhood.
How old were you when you started hanging out there?
Well, I didn't hang out so much as I swept the floor. And,
right.
Well, we lived above the tavern.
Oh.
You always did that. I mean, that you didn't have absentee tavern owners. Most taverns came with a flat in the back or a flat upstairs, so you lived there. So that was really just the first floor of my home. It's where the music came from. It's kind of nice. Developed a pretty good taste for Glenn Miller and the big bands of the era. Because unlike most kids had to listen to a little radio, I had a great big jukebox downstairs.
Right. Did people treat you really well there, all the patrons of the tavern, since you were the son of the owner?
Well, they had to because I tended bar. I started tending bar when I was 12 or 13, so That was due to, in those days, taverns had very friendly relations with the police. You had local police stations, and every Saturday, the bag man, the captain's man, would come around, and I'd give him an envelope, and that assured us that if there was a fight in the tavern, they'd respond quickly, and the fact that I was only 13, they would accept my father's word that I was an elderly midget, and could tend bar. I was treated well. I was more generous than my father when it came to giving them free drinks. So they liked me and the customers. And
say, how much money was in that envelope?
I never looked. It was sealed. That was a matter between my father and the local police commander. Although he told me years ago, years later, one of the newspapers in Chicago opened a tavern. They had investigative reporters open a tavern and just wait to see what happens when you own a tavern in Chicago. And pretty soon people came in, building inspectors and the police and different parts of the local government seeking bribes of one kind or another. And my father was amazed when he read the story at how inflation hadn't really had that great an impact on bribes, because he told me that in the 40s he was paying more than that. And so since I didn't work on the paper that did this expose, I did a piece saying that the main thing we've seen is that the people who take bribes in Chicago are kind of dumb. They haven't really kept up with inflation.
Now, your father took bets on horses, and didn't you have to run some of the money to, to a bookie?
Well, my father, the fact that he took bets made him a bookie. Anybody who takes...
But you had to run into a mafia bookie, though, didn't
you? Well, yeah, because at a certain point, if you're just a small... if you're a tavern and you have a... but you take bets on horses or other sporting events from customers, there's a point of danger when you can't cover a large bet, or you can't cover if there's a lot of heavy betting on some event, and should you lose, you don't have the capital. And in those days, my father, today he could probably just go and go to the junk bond people and borrow several $1 million. And cover it, but in those days, if you couldn't pay off, you'd have trouble. You know, like your legs might get broken. So it was a routine. You would go to the big bookie. You weren't operating without the big bookie's permission in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would just take the overflow or the big bets and lay them off with the big guy, because he could cover them. And it was his responsibility, since you were also paying him a fee, a franchise fee, in effect, to stay in business.
So what? Yeah.
Really does sound like basic American businesses today. You know, for you, bookies were franchised, and you go to the guy with them, and instead of going to Wall Street for the extra dough, you go to a syndicate guy down the street who is probably just as honest.
Well, did you or your father, though, ever get into any trouble with the mafia?
Oh, no. My father used to go to the Kentucky Derby for a year with these people. They were nice people. Most of them were... They rarely get involved in violence. That really, they try to avoid that. They're not like the modern... Scarface, Al Pacino-type criminals who go around shooting up the joint at the drop of an insult. Nor are they glamorous, operatic-type figures, as in Coppola's movies, The Godfather saga. But they're just ordinary thugs who are just making a living.
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is syndicated columnist Mike Royko, and he's been writing a column in his hometown of Chicago for over 26 years. A collection of his recent columns are in the book, Dr. Kuki, You're Right. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist Mike Royko is my guest. When you started attending bar when you were 12 years old, what was some of the advice your father gave you about when to talk to a customer and when to just be quiet and when, if ever, to stop serving a customer if they were really drunk or if they were causing trouble?
I don't recall his ever having to give me any advice because I had grown up in the atmosphere, before I attended bar, I used to, you know, my job was sweeping up, and I sort of absorbed it. You know, there really isn't that complicated to attend bar in a neighborhood tavern. You didn't have to know how to make a martini. I don't think anybody ever ordered one. The standard drinks were a shot or a beer or a shot and a beer. Women generally had a highball, you know, just a shot of bourbon with some ginger ale in it. I don't recall anybody ever asking for champagne or a pink lady or anything, a daiquiri. I think my father would have told them, why don't you go to a Spanish neighborhood if you want a daiquiri, whatever that is. We just didn't have, it was a very easy job. Anybody could tend bar.
Do you think it's helped you as a columnist to have grown up around a tavern?
Well, it helped me as a Chicago columnist, I think, to have grown up in Chicago. When I wrote 1971, I published a book on sort of an unauthorized biography, or really not a biography, just sort of a subjective view of Richard J. Daley and the city and the political machine. And when people asked me when I started researching the book, I said, yeah, I probably started research about when I was 7 or 8 years old, when I started understanding how things worked in this city. And I was well into my research by the time I was handing the sergeant the envelope. And yeah, if you grew up in a town, it helps a lot when you write, if you're going to write about it.
Mm-hmm. But have you ever... like consciously gone to hang out at a bar specifically just to overhear a conversation, see what people were talking about?
No, actually not. I don't go in that many bars. I'm at a point in life where I can't do my work and sit around in bars. It's just only so many hours in the day.
Mm-hmm. Were there columns that you wrote early on that got you into trouble with City Hall, that really aggravated the people in City Hall early on in your career?
Oh, well, yeah. When Richard J. Daley was mayor of Chicago, I was probably his major adversary, which showed what a cushy deal he had. I was better known than the people who ran against him, and I gave him more grief than the people who ran against him. And... but someone had to do it, and he was fun. He was fun to write about. The machines. See, the papers had never really covered, as far as I was concerned, the real politics in Chicago, and they had never described people in politics in Chicago the way they should have been. And I started going to city council meetings and taking recorders with me, and then I would print exactly what aldermen said, and people would say to me, "My God, that was a great expose." just quoting them.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started going to Mayor Daley's press conferences and doing the same thing and quoting him precisely. And that was fun for a while. I did a number of columns. But then the press secretary said that if I didn't stop, he'd stop holding press conferences. So the press corps in City Hall pleaded with me, "Go away, or we will be cut off from the source of information." But I kind of pioneered realism of Chicago politics, and I recall with some relish in 1968, a week before the convention, I wrote a column about what the Democrats could expect when they came to Chicago in 1968, what kind of guy Daley was and what the machine was like. And I believe it was the L.A. Times, which got my column over our wire at the time, rejected. They didn't want to print that. Instead, they got a guy in Chicago, a college professor, to write a piece on Daley. And it was a very laudatory piece on how he was misunderstood, et cetera, et cetera. And after the L.A. Times stopped paying the hospital bills for all the reporters who got whacked on the head that they had here, after the convention, one of the editors told me, he says, "I think we made a mistake. I think maybe we should have printed your piece instead." People didn't understand Chicago politics, even a lot of Chicagoans didn't. So if I made any contribution with my column in Chicago, that was about it.
How do you think Chicago politics have changed?
Oh, it's more conventional now. It's closer to being politics as it is in other cities. With the added ingredient of race, but that's we're not the first to have that. And it's changed because there is no longer a dominant political machine. That's changed for a number of reasons, primarily legal decisions that have almost killed off about 98% of all political patronage. When Daley became mayor, he controlled a minimum of 40,000 jobs. And a rule of thumb in Chicago is that each job is worth a minimum of 10 votes automatic. So you had this gigantic machine with loyalty to one guy, ultimately, the Daley, who was both the mayor and the head of the party. That's changed.
Mm-hmm.
Today. You've got two parties in Chicago. You have the White Party and the Black Party.
You think it divides that clearly?
It couldn't be divided any more clearly than that.
Of all the columns you've written over the years, can you single out any one of them as having the most impact?
Oh, gosh, no. No, I can't. But that's not why I do a column. I do columns because I think that at some point in the newspaper, somebody should be able to stop, take a breather, and get a laugh. And that's basically what I try to do with my columns. I don't try to take things, even when I try to take things seriously, I try to write them in such a way that the reader will go away with at least having a laugh once or twice.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your columns and about your life. Thank you.
Thank you.
Syndicated columnist Mike Royko. His latest collection of columns is called Dr. Kooky, You're Right. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be 60 Minutes correspondent Morley Safer. His new book, Flashbacks, is about his experiences reporting from Vietnam and about his recent return to Vietnam. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction.
Some of rap's biggest stars have gotten together in a group called Stop the Violence to raise consciousness about black-on-black crime at rap concerts and in inner-city neighborhoods. Coming up, we meet music critic Nelson George. He's one of the organizers of Stop the Violence. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews Fall from Grace. It's a made-for-TV movie about televangelists Jim and Tammy Baker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
Well, today's topic, self-destruction. It really ain't the rap audience that's bugging. It's one or two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Washington, President Bush is reportedly ready to announce a series of economic sanctions against the Soviet Union in response to Moscow's crackdown on Lithuania. The Associated Press is reporting that the president is expected to outline his plans at a meeting tomorrow at the White House with congressional leaders. The president will reportedly announce a postponement and withholding of a number of trade and economic concessions that the Soviet Union is seeking from the United States. Former hostage Robert Polhill is undergoing medical testing in Wiesbaden, West Germany, as the White House works to determine what led to his release. The Bush administration today repeated its policy of making no deals in exchange for the freedom for the rest of the hostages now held in Lebanon. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The White House says it will continue to look for every opportunity to bring about the release of the seven American hostages in the Middle East. But spokesman Marlon Fitzwater repeated the long-standing policy against making deals for their freedom. He explained that only the unconditional release of all hostages would open the door to better relations with Iran. The Reagan administration tried to encourage the release of hostages in what came to be viewed as an arms-for-hostage deal. Fitzwater said the U.S. is consulting with its friends in the Middle East to find out the reasons behind Polhill's release and the possibility of the release of the others. Administration officials say it is anybody's guess as to when the other hostages will be set free. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
In Florida, the countdown clock is running smoothly at the Kennedy Space Center. Tomorrow, NASA will try once again to launch the Space Shuttle Discovery for the long-awaited deployment of the Hubble Space Telescope. Dave Pignanelli reports.
The countdown for the liftoff of Discovery picked up just after 6 Eastern time tonight, after showers passed through the Kennedy Space Center. Weather should not be a factor tomorrow morning. Forecasters predict an 80% chance of favorable weather. This is launch attempt number 2 for Discovery. 2 weeks ago, a power unit aboard the orbiter faltered, causing managers to scrub the attempt and to delay the much-anticipated deployment of the $1.5 billion Hubble Space Telescope. If all goes as planned, the Discovery crew will deploy Hubble on Wednesday in an orbit 380 miles above the Earth. Launch time tomorrow morning is set for 8:31 Eastern time. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Orlando.
General Motors says it plans to close its Pontiac West Light Truck Assembly Plant in Pontiac, Michigan by the end of 1993. The closing will affect some 2,000 workers. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 29 points to close at 2,666.67, volume 136 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rap music is over a decade old now, and as it's matured, it's also become more diverse. There are party boasts, sexual brags. You can even hear raps for hamburgers and soft drinks on TV commercials. But there's a segment of rap that's become very controversial, a more hostile style that brags about street violence, that is crude in its views of women and homophobic in its references to gays. The group Public Enemy, whose record Fight the Power was used in the film Do the Right Thing, has been associated with anti-Semitic comments. Rap concerts have been accused of inciting violence. Now there's a group called Stop the Violence. My guest Nelson George is one of the organizers. He's a music critic, Village Voice columnist, and the author of books about Motown, rhythm and blues, and Michael Jackson. Stop the Violence is a collaborative effort featuring such rap stars as Kool Moe Dee, KRS-One, Chuck D, and Flavor Flav. They've recorded a single called Self-Destruction.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
It really ain't the rap audience that's bugging. It's one or two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another. You get caught in the mid. So to crush that stereotype, here's what we did. We got ourselves together so that you could unite and fight for what's right. Not negative cause. The way we live is positive. We don't kill our relatives.
Pop, 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 when it's shot, who's to blame? Headline, front page, and rap's the name. MC Delight here to state the bottom line. The black on black crime was way before our time.
Took a brother's life with a knife as his wife cried because he died a trifling death when he left his very last breath. Was I slept, so watch your step. Back in the 60s, our brothers and sisters were hanged. How could you gangbang? I never ever ran from the Ku Klux Klan, and I shouldn't have to run from a black man, because that's
self-destruction.
What are some of the problems that Stop the Violence was formed to address?
Well, the real spark, the first spark, was actually a incident that happened at the Nassau Coliseum going back a couple of years now. We were at a rap show. A young man was stabbed to death over a gold chain, and a number of other kids were really beat up pretty badly. And the media coverage of it, from the point of view of us who were involved, we in the rap community, as it were, was that rap music causes violence. And it is our opinion that the same things that happen at rap concerts are no different than the same things that happen at public schools or in playgrounds or in city streets all across America. We have poverty. We have an incredible drug problem. We have a lot of other really terrible things going on in society affecting young people. And a rap concert is in no different venue than any of these other places where we have incidents of especially youth on youth crime occurring. So to blame a musical form, as the media tended to do, for things that really have more to do with ills in the general American society, we thought was quite unfair.
You mentioned violence at a rap concert a few years ago. That was one of the reasons that you formed Stop the Violence. What are the other problems that Stop the Violence was formed to address?
Well, I think that's really the bottom line is mm-hmm. to deal with the perception of rap music and to deal with the audience's perception of themselves. Rap serves as an alternative media outlet. It's one of the few places in this country where a black youth can communicate directly to other black youths ideas and concepts, feelings, emotions, without having to go through the censorship or the perceptions of the media. And when I say perceptions, even when someone is interviewed by a TV show or a radio show or whatever, magazine, it's still the interpreter who has the final say in what is said. Rap music is a place where people speak directly to their audience. And I think that was very important as well.
There are rappers from the group Public Enemy in Stop the Violence. And this is a group that's been criticized for its anti-Semitic comments, both on and off record. And in the recent Daniel Village Voice music poll, the rock critic Grail Marcus said that he refused to participate in the annual music poll because he was afraid it would further legitimize Public Enemy and the hate that they're trading on. I was wondering what you thought of the controversy surrounding them and of their participation in a group that's supposed to be putting out, you know, a positive message.
Public Enemy is the most important black artistic musical group to come out of rap. I think It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back is a record on par with What's Going On by Marvin Gaye 10 years earlier. I don't believe that Welcome to the Terror Dome is an anti-Semitic record, and I believe that Public Enemy is a very important group, and I don't feel that because there was attacks from outside of the community, that should keep them off the record in any way. I think that they've made some bad moves, obviously, but I don't think that invalidates the bulk of their music.
Music critic Nelson George is my guest. He's one of the organizers of Stop the Violence. It's a collective effort by rap music stars to raise their fans' consciousness about black-on-black crime. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Nelson George is my guest. He's one of the organizers of the rap music movement Stop the Violence. I wonder what your attitude is toward the band N.W.A. And this is a rap group that's one of the most controversial rap groups now because in their raps they portray themselves as ruthless gangsters. In fact, they have a song, Gangsta Gangsta, in which part of the rap is, take a life or two, that's what I do. You don't like how I'm living, then F you. And there's a lot of obscenity in it. There's a lot of very explicit language about crime. what's your impressions of them?
Well, I'm not a fan of all of the stuff they do. I think that as many would say, they in many ways glorify some of the worst aspects of what's going on in the general society. On the other hand, I think a song like F the Police, which is one of the more controversial songs that they did, which basically attacks cops for, quote-unquote, attacking black youth, is as pungent a bit of social commentary as anything you read anywhere else. I think N.W.A. is important because, and have been popular, without any radio play, because they articulate a lot of the rage and hostility toward authority that's in the black community today among black youth. The incident in Teaneck, New Jersey, where the young black boy was shot by the police under mysterious circumstances, and the riot that came, I think, the next day or the day after, is also a reflection of the same energy that creates N.W.A. Just as I said, what rap has become, and I think what makes it so frightening and such a lightning rod for so much controversy is that it speaks without censorship and without fear to white America about some of the things that they don't want to know exist or some of the feelings that they're afraid of. And the bottom line is that a group like N.W.A., who I don't agree with everything they do, but I believe that what they say, for the most part, has a lot of validity in reflecting the attitudes of their audience. When you listen to N.W.A., you shouldn't be afraid of the group. You should be afraid of the fact there's a whole bunch of people who agree with what they say, and people need to be figuring out why they agree with what they say and what can be done about correcting the conditions that create those attitudes.
Got him.
What are some of the controversies now among black parents about dealing with rap music? I know some parents who really don't want their young teenagers exposed to the more explicit raps because they think it's going to create really bad role models, really dangerous ambitions for their kids.
Well, I think if they feel that way, they should be monitoring what their kids listen to. I also think they should also not let their children watch Miami Vice, which used to be on, or any of the other violent things that pass for entertainment in the United States of America. If they're concerned about images of young men talking about robbing and stealing, then they shouldn't also be looking at primetime TV in America, which is rife with images of young men robbing and stealing. The gun is one of the great American fetish symbols. You can't take rap out of the context of America. America's a violent country. It was founded on violence. It uses violence to assert its will around the globe. And the fact that black kids have picked up on the same fetishes of violence is not surprising.
There's a lot going on now in terms of labeling of records. And for instance, I mean, just recently, the record industry decided to voluntarily label records, things like parental warnings for explicit lyrics, in the hopes that voluntary labeling would prevent more legislation that would require labeling. What do you think of labeling?
Some people are against it. I actually think if we're gonna take the position, that, as I do, that we don't want federal regulation, we don't want state legislatures deciding what's obscene and not obscene, then we have to give parents an opportunity to make these judgments. I think it makes sense. I think if I don't have any kids, but I have nieces who are 10, 11 years old, I think it's good that my sister can look at the record and make some kind of judgment. Well, what's on this record that I should be concerned about? So, I mean, I don't really have a problem with it in that level. Voluntary stickering doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm. You recently wrote that for you, rap music was both a professional and an aesthetic inspiration. What were you getting at there?
Well, my career has really been based, I mean, I started writing professionally in the late 70s. I was working at a newspaper called the Amsterdam News, which is a black newspaper in New York City. And rap music was born at just about the same time that I was sort of growing up, coming of age. I saw a lot of the famous, now legendary hip-hop guys in the Bronx and Harlem and Brooklyn. And most of the early pieces I sold to the Village Voice were rap pieces. And throughout my career, it's been rap music, which I think has informed a lot of my listening and also my attitudes toward the general society. Precisely because rap has expressed so directly the attitudes of the everyday black kid or everyday black person is why it's so valuable. Almost singular. I mean, singular any in terms of genres of American music right now. We could take any sampling of quality rap records and put them in a time capsule and open them up in the year 2020 and have a much better idea about how a great many Americans lived in this particular time period than we will from almost any other expression. And in terms of music, at least, I mean, I don't think you get a lot from most of the mainstream rock and roll about the nuances from attitudes toward the government, toward what people wore on their feet, from sneakers to Jeeps. Rap records are really a catalog of pop culture in a way that almost no other form of music is.
A few years ago, when rap was just getting started, a lot of people thought that it was just the latest novelty and it would come and go really quickly. That, of course, hasn't happened. And you say that the question is no longer will rap last, but who's going to control it? Who are the various parties here vying for control over rap music?
Well, I mean, it's amazing the changeover. I mean, what I'm seeing now is I'm seeing guys who start out in hip-hop with me, who are my peers, are sort of like in their early 30s now, who are now getting jobs as head of promotion departments at record companies. So you see a lot of that energy that came off the street becoming part of the mainstream. And I'm a little worried that everyone's going to turn into three-piece suit guys in a minute. So that's what I'm getting at. I'm getting at the co-optation of the talent may lead eventually to a watering down of the music and a watering down of this rebel attitude which spawns N.W.A.'s, because I think if you just have Young M.C. and Tone Loc, you're not having what it is about rap that's exciting.
Well, you know, it's interesting, a group like N.W.A., they can't possibly be played on radio with the language that they use.
And that's the whole point, they can't be. And why should they be? If they can sell a million records without radio play, then that means that there's something legitimately exciting about that record that people don't need radio to tell them what to buy. And I consider prospects of that, considering the narrow vision that most radio programmers have of what about music is about and what our society is about, the fact that groups like this exist and that they can be successful without the structures that exist for controlling music is very positive.
So you see a parallel here. On the one hand, some of the rap is getting more and more into mainstream, on commercials, on TV, rap styles getting integrated into mainstream hits. On the other hand, you've got groups like N.W.A. getting more and more extreme in their lyrics, both in the language that they use and in the stories that they're telling.
Well, I'm funny you say extreme. I mean, I would say the dichotomy between a young MC who's damn near a black Republican and N.W.A. is quite a large gap. But on the other hand, I don't see, quite honestly, what the things that on N.W.A. records are any more extreme than reading the New York Post. I mean, the same things are in there. People are getting killed constantly. The New York City, this was just, I think, came out the other day, is the murder capital of or at least the robbery capital of the United States.
I guess
that's what rap records do. They, unlike most other forms of popular music, are not narcotics. They don't put you to sleep. They slap you in the face with the reality of what's going on.
I guess the difference between the Post and N.W.A. is that the Post is going to report that it happened in very flamboyant language, maybe, but in N.W.A., the stories are told from the perspective of the person doing the crime.
And that's what's it. And that's, I mean, the thing I also think about rap music is that I, maybe just because I see these guys, and I think sometimes, in the same way that people can go see a Rambo movie and walk away and not feel that Sylvester Stallone is Rambo.
Mm-hmm.
Just because a rapper sings a song from the point of view of a perpetrator doesn't mean he is the perpetrator. What he is he's taking the point of view of that person to tell that story, in the same way that Bob Dylan took the point of view of a lot of different bad people over the years to tell the stories he wanted to tell. I mean, I think people are dropping their artistic guard because they're offended by the message and not looking at the artistry of the message. You can't divorce rap music and take it as a genre that's different from all other forms of music and use judgment on it that you wouldn't use to describe Mick Jagger singing Sympathy for the Devil.
Nelson George, thanks a lot for doing the interview.
Okay, thanks.
Music critic Nelson George is one of the organizers of Stop the Violence and the editor of a new book by the same name. Profits from the book and from the group's record Self-Destruction are being donated to the National Urban League.
To merge, we live for the love of our people, the hope they get along.
Yeah, so
getting a point to our brothers and sisters who don't know the time.
Boy, so we run around.
Instead in your head, you know our job to build and collect ourselves with intellect. To revolve, to evolve the self-respect.
Cause we got to keep ourselves in check. Or else it's
This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing more about the release of Robert Polhill, who was hostage for 39 months in Lebanon, and some of the diplomacy that might have gone on to bring that about. And we'll be hearing from an expert on the Shiite Lebanese movement Hezbollah on how his release might be playing in southern Lebanon today. He says that the Shiites are bound to portray it as a great victory for them. Also, we'll be repeating a report we did on the 10th anniversary of the evacuation of Saigon by U.S. forces as we approach the 15th anniversary. It's a very extraordinary report by Noah Adams and Art Silverman that we think of as Goodbye Saigon.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The demise of the empire that Jim and Tammy Faye Baker built is the subject of a TV movie that airs this Sunday night on NBC. It's called Fall from Grace. Television critic David Bianculli has this preview.
Fall from Grace would be easier to like if the script were better, or if the acting were worse. Let's face it, we all know what the Bakers look like, and sound like, and act like. Even if you didn't see Ted Koppel interview them on Nightline, or watch the Jessica Hahn-Jim Baker scandal on the network newscasts, you probably bumped into the Jim and Tammy act while flipping through TV channels. Now, I realize a lot of people thought the Bakers were charismatic, but to me, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were like human chipmunks. Big wet eyes, small squeaky voices, puffy little cheeks. To me, Jim and Tammy were highly unlikely TV stars. I thought he projected all the sincerity of Joe Isuzu, while she sang like, well, put it this way. When Tammy Faye Baker stepped up to sing, I stepped up to change channels again. That's one of the reasons this TV movie doesn't work. Jim Baker is played by Kevin Spacey, who played the Looney Tunes' Mel Profit on Wise Guy, and who is way too handsome, charming, and intense to play Jim Baker. And Tammy Faye Baker is played by Bernadette Peters, who's too attractive even under all those layers of makeup. Besides, her singing makes you want to tune in, not tune out.
Oh, when the number one.
With actors this talented playing the Bakers, it's easier to accept the Bakers' rise as TV preachers. But the script doesn't bother dramatizing their early years anyway. That's dumb, because it's probably the least known and most interesting stuff. Instead, it begins in 1980, with Jim Baker's hotel room meeting with Jessica Hahn. And they don't dare show anything there but a slightly suggestive back rub. The rest of the movie dodges more issues than it raises, and is more sympathetic than damning. Especially towards Tammy Faye, whose drug abuse and Imelda Marcos-type shopping sprees are explained away by her husband's inattentiveness.
Be nice if once in a while you'd say, I love you.
I say it all day to strangers.
Well, then skip the words. Look at me a little more. Touch me a little more.
Don't you think I want to? Time's the problem. There's never enough of it. And if you want to get anywhere in this world, you gotta run faster than everyone else.
I don't want to run anymore.
That personal stuff is the prime focus of Fall from Grace, which means that the religious, financial, and moral issues aren't raised often enough. And those famous Nightline interviews aren't dramatized. And this movie gives the mistaken impression that Jim was a bigger crier than Tammy. Neither of them has anything to cry about in this NBC movie, though. Fall from Grace lets them off easy and makes them look a lot more talented than they were.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, Dan Lachlan, and Thad Kirk. Chris Bergen directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Vietnam was called television's first war. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Morley Safer, one of the first journalists who brought the violence of the war into our living rooms. Also, a talk with animator Bill Plimpton. You may have seen his Plimtoons on MTV. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.
You can hear sound passages Monday through Thursday nights at 11 and weekday mornings between 5 and 6. It's a great way to start or end your day right here on WHYY-FM, Philadelphia.
It's 8 o'clock on 91 FM. My name is Melinda Whiting and our engineer for evening class...